got a listener email.
Oh, really?
I mean, I've got more than that, but there's just one I'm going to read out.
As in, there's more than one listener email?
Yeah, there is.
Really? Is there?
Yeah, if you just email to moviesyouforgot@gmail.com, they flood in.
Yeah.
But before I do that, actually, I've got to give a shout out to a Discord. You're supposed to do Discord stuff, but I'm going to do a Discord. Joe_AK on the Discord. Join the Discord, guys. Link in the show notes. He shared this amazing link to, it's called No CGI is Just Invisible CGI, but it's by the movie Rabbit Hole. And Joe AK said, this series of YouTube videos is about CGI and the way people in the media talk about CGI, specifically the popular idea that it's virtuous to avoid CGI and that lots of directors have gone to great lengths to do that.
Nolan?
Nolan does come up, but he's more pristine than some.
Right.
But anyway, I'm four episodes in. It's really fantastic. I'd recommend everyone just, I guess, Google the movie Rabbit Hole and No CGI. Yeah, so I just do that. Get on the Discord as well. But anyway, back to my listener email.
I just wanted to say, I too saw that message, and I just haven't had time to watch it yet. Because I've got a lot of stuff going on, you know. I don't like, unlike you, I don't have the capacity, the ability to just pop on a YouTube link, you know, willy nilly. So the suggestion that I'm not upholding my end of the deal, aka the Discord, very unfair. Because that message only came in yesterday. You've jumped. That's like the hottest potato, and you've just shoved it up your little asshole, haven't you? And then spit it out of your mouth at me.
That message is about a week old.
Oh, okay.
This tease wonderfully to the listener email that I've got, and it's all about eating humble pie.
Oh yeah, the one email.
It's all about eating humble pie and things you say.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's from Ari.
Things I say or things you say?
Well, both of us need to eat humble pie.
Okay.
It's from listener Ari. Good evening, both. I've been through your podcast history once before, and I'm now redoing it as its lovely background ambience. I don't like that. You got me through a 25-mile walk the other day.
A 25-mile walk? That's a marathon.
Yeah, but just walking.
Why would someone do a 25-mile walk and not call it a marathon? You don't have to run a marathon. You can walk a marathon. Wait, is it 26.1 miles? Is that a marathon?
I like Ari because they're not self-aggrandizing. They've not gone mad. They've not said, oh, marathon. They've just stated the number.
I think it's like one of those things where you're making such an effort to be humble that you've actually sort of, you've kind of done a double reverse. And by saying a 25-mile walk instead of just saying a marathon, which is what it is, you've sort of made it sound like you're deliberately obfuscating it, but in a way as to draw attention to the fact that you've done that. So it's like a humble brag. Do you know what I mean?
I disagree because I don't even know how long a marathon is. I've got no interest in a marathon. And I think Ari is likewise, to me, like not interested in that kind of grandiosity. Oh, I'm doing the London Marathon. No, just going for a walk.
Let me put it to you. If Ari wasn't interested in that kind of grandiosity, then why didn't he just say I was going for a walk? Why did he say I went for a 25-mile walk? You know?
Well, it could be she could be a woman. Ari could be, okay. Might not be. Anyway, it's quite nice. The fact that we were the background ambience to a 25-mile walk, I think, is lovely. I'm on episode 61. With Crouching Tiger, and you both have just discussed your female four Dan picks.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
You remember the Dan?
That was good.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where we were talking about.
That was surely all accurate. I can't imagine anything wrong with that.
Well, we were talking about Michelle Yeoh, and she's one of the Dans. And yeah, then you said to me, oh, Adam, who are your four Dans? Joe suggests Margot Robbie, and Adam wishes to serve up some humble pie to him about the then-eventual Robbie filmography post-Barbie. Forgive me if it occurs in another episode, but I'm curious to get Adam's thoughts on her two films and how much pie Joe can eat. Thanks both. Love the pod.
What?
This is... No.
Who's eating pie? Is it me? Is it you?
I don't know. Ari has raised the there's possible pie. I don't actually think, I've thought about this quite some time. I don't think there's any pie to eat just yet. I just thought, I listened back to the episode and you were so swift.
What did I say?
Well, I'll tell you. You asked me who are my four Dans, And I said, well, I'm going to keep it Western. And I went...
What was the Dan again, though? I don't know. Like, I can't remember. And the listeners might not know.
The four top actresses. They're like blockbuster, you know. And so you went, for example, you're saying Sandra Bullock. But before that, you went instantly. You asked me and I said some names. But you said, I can't believe you're not saying Margot Robbie. And I said, Margot Robbie, mm-hmm. She's nothing. One movie doesn't make you a star. And this is Barbie.
Right.
And then I made a joke about it. I was like, well, I mean, you know, it does. The Terminator makes a star. Rocky made a star. But I sort of said that she doesn't have any staying power, and I don't think she'll be a Dan. There, I can see you Googling. Now, she's done two films, post-Barbie. That's not a lot of movies.
Yeah, I'm checking what they are.
She did a big, bold journey with... Colin Farrell.
Yeah, a big, bold, beautiful journey with Colin Farrell.
Directed by Coganada, which is obviously her art house play. And then she was in mm-hmm. Wuthering Heights, directed by Emerald Fennell. A real critical bomb, but did make a fair whack of money.
And let me say also, we often have to gauge our perspective on these things through the prism of choices, don't we? Choices. Because that was Emerald Fennell's big follow-up to, what's that movie where the guy has sex with the grave? Saltburn, to the Barry Keoghan Saltburn. Now, she was hot on the scene, big talk. Everyone was excited about Emerald Fennell. There was buzz aplenty amongst Hollywood. So I feel as though if you're Margot Robbie, I think that's an okay choice to make, and that it's Wuthering Heights, and there's a, you know, it's a famous text as well. I think it's a shame that I haven't actually seen the film, but it's a shame that critically speaking, the film wasn't received positively. However, decent choice on the part of Margot Robbie, and it made a lot of money, like you said.
Yeah. I mean, the other one, big, bold journey with Colin Farrell, Coganaga, very highly regarded on the indie scene. He directed a film I really like called Columbus. This went down very badly. It was considered a real art house stinker.
Right.
And so this is where we get into, it may be a good choice, but she's chosen badly because the project's bad. And then also her name can't open the picture. People haven't gone to see it because she's in it. So it suggests she's not a Dan.
Well, I mean, also they spent $45 million on that film. So surely that can't be considered an indie movie either. That's a huge amount of money to spend on a small film like that.
Right. Yeah, they probably given it more budget because they got Margot in and Colin Farrell.
Who was also on a big hot tip at the time, right? Like after playing the Penguin and such, I feel like Colin was the guy of that, or like one of the kind of adjacent guys of that year. So it does in some ways, it adds fuel to the fire of my Dan choice. Because they've paired the Dan with the Don, you know, of that time to make this film. The film hasn't worked out, of course.
Farrell's not a Dan. He's not the equivalent Dan.
No.
Damon's a Dan, and Gosling's a Dan. There's four Dans. There's only four Dans. It's Gosling, Damon, Ryan Reynolds, and maybe Vin Diesel.
Are we just saying Damon because of the Odyssey? Damon wasn't a Dan before Christopher Nolan put him in the Odyssey, right? Like, he hasn't been a Dan for 10 years.
Right, but he's a Dan again.
He's a Dan again?
Yeah.
I wonder if he's a Dan even less than he was before. A Don, we're saying.
Anyway, Colin Farrell's not a Dan. Mm. But it's interesting, Margot Robbie now, I think she's eating humble pie. She's sniffing around Barbie 2. And she's in a prequel to the Ocean's 11's movie, which is set in the 60s. She needs a hit, man. She needs a hit big.
She needs a hit bad. Yeah, and if she doesn't get one, could be curtains for Robbie. That's what you're saying. Yeah.
Will you eat some humble pie, a little bit, a little sliver of pie?
No, because I think none of the women that you referenced were Dans either. If Margot Robbie doesn't count as a Dan, then none of them do. That's... Then what we're saying is that there aren't any women Dans, and that that's a problem with the industry.
Absolutely. Again, we're on the same page. I mean, maybe you could consider Amy Adams, Emma Stone.
No.
I said, yeah.
Maybe.
Emma Stone is the closest to a Jessica Chastain was sniffing around the Dan, but she's not anymore. She's done too many straight. No. Charlize Theron was a Dan for a bit, but you're right. I mean, the blatant misogyny of Hollywood and wider society.
That's who should eat pie, the misogynists, not you and me. You know, we're fighting against that kind of thing by pointing out that there aren't any women Dans.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to be the host, and Joe prefers to be the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmondo. This is... Sorry, I forgot to say that. My name's Adam Richmond, in case... You think my name's Adam Richmondo. This is the show where we talk about the movies or films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. And joining me as ever is me old leaky bucket boy compadre in chatting and remembering of movies. He struggles to remember and retain things he's seen and then speak about them. You know, that's what it is. He's got a bucket for a head and he's got fucking... shit for opinions. It's Mr. Joe Devine.
It's terrible qualifications, really, for a podcaster, isn't it? You know, struggles to retain information and speak about it. Those are really, I would say, the two main requirements of a podcaster. But alas, you know, we live in a strange world.
On today's episode, we are doing... Oh, why did Letterboxd lose it? We are doing the 19...
I know what it is. Oh.
We're doing the 1997 Luc Besson directed The Fifth Element, aka Le Cinquième Element. It's 126 mins. It feels like 140 mins. And it stars Bruce Willis, Mila Jovovich, Gary Oldman, Ian Holm, Chris Tucker. And that's all about it you need to know. Here's the Letterboxd. There is no future without it. Without what? In 2057, a taxi driver, Bruce Willis, and I would also say he's a former kind of commando kind of guy, is unintentionally given the task of saving a young girl, Mila Jovovich, who is part of the key that will ensure the survival of humanity. And that's all you get.
Right. Would you like to hear the IMDb?
Yeah, a little bit more detail from IMDb, please.
In the colourful future... Cab driver Corbin Dallas unwittingly becomes the central figure in the search for a legendary cosmic weapon to keep the great evil and Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg at bay.
You let me get you on this, even though technically I kind of cheated because I'd watched it in my day-to-day life prior to the podcast, and I said, please, can we do it? Because I want to, you know, I'm a busy boy too. It takes up a lot of time. Doing this podcast, I've done a whole series of solo episodes whilst you've been off on your jollies.
Have you?
Yeah, no, you probably haven't heard them, but yeah, I've just done recorded these solo episodes.
Sounds good, man.
I just wanted a little bit of respite, so I begged you to do that. I thought you'd be classier about it, but you let everyone know at the end of the episode that I was a cheat. So we're doing Fifth Element. What do you remember about the Fifth Element and the year 1997?
Well, I remember very little about the year 1997 other than the smell of fresh-cut grass and the sound of the little dewy stream bubbling... well, what do they call it? A bubbling brook? A babbling brook. The sound of the babbling brook along the back of our house and the feel of the burning sun on my back as I worked in the fields and looking for stones and digging up stones. And there was one tree in the centre of the meadow at the back of our house. And there was a cow. Or maybe there wasn't a cow. Maybe there was just the threat of a cow peril of a cow. Those are the things I remember from 1997. What do I remember about the film The Fifth Element? Well, I remember, you know, Mila Jovovich's a body, to be candid and indiscreet, because I would have seen this film for the first time when I was a teenager, and it doesn't leave a lot to the imagination. I remember Chris Tucker in the sort of famous role as the radio DJ, which was interesting to watch from with a modern perspective, because it felt a lot like he was a live streamer or something, like a Twitch live streamer, you know. And I remember the opera scene as well.
I've seen there are Instagram posts where they played that clip of Chris Tucker, and they kind of go, oh, someone knew what was going to happen in the future. I fucking hate those things so much. It's not really what's going on at all.
I did write something down, though, along those lines, and as I was writing it, I knew that you would hate it because I used the word prescient. I didn't use it to describe Chris Tucker. I thought about that, but then I also realised that, well, no, Chris Tucker's character was aping, you know, famous cultural icons of the time. There were a lot of American radio DJs who, you know, had these extreme personalities, and they broadcast for an hour a time like Chris Tucker does. In fact, when you watch it with that perspective, you realise that there's actually very little prescient about Chris Tucker's character, although he does, you know, his character does remind you of a live streamer, because live streamers are all based on famous radio DJs of the past. The thing I thought was very prescient was Luc Besson's use of Bruce Willis's cat. Bruce Willis's cat at home watching the TV. It's a very cute cat. I don't know, I feel like he was somehow connected to this this cat related reality that the internet would blossom with afterwards. It's fair to say, I think, that if an alien came to Earth and looked at the internet to see what it was all about, I do believe after porn, they would mainly see cats and think that cats had like this hugely outsized role in human culture. You know how we look at cats in ancient Egyptian drawings on pyramid walls and stuff, and we think, oh, they loved cats, didn't they? That maybe they praised cats. I feel like someone who didn't know anything about us would look at the internet and say, why do they fucking love cats so much? They really love cats. So that felt like very modern when I was watching it. But beyond that, there was loads about this film I didn't remember. My main experience of watching it was watching one scene and going, oh yeah, I remember this scene like beat for beat. And then watching the next scene and going, I have no memory of ever seeing this, you know? Maybe that's because I would say 80% of the time I've spent watching this film was watching bits of it when it was on TV. And I'm sure, you know, I would have watched it all the way through once before, but as a composite, I would have seen those most famous scenes many times, and some of the others maybe once or twice. What about you? What do you most remember about it?
I remember seeing it at the cinema in, like, maybe Piccadilly Circus, a cinema around there.
Oh, really?
1997. I think I would have gone into town. Was I in sixth form then? I think I was in sixth form, just before university.
Wow. Yeah. That makes sense, because you are 10 years older than me.
Trocadero. It feels like it was evocative of the Trocadero. And I too remember, I mean, the production design first, and then Mila Jovovich's side boob second.
Yeah.
So it looks great. Jean-Paul Gaultier did the costumes. There's a really fun riff on Bruce Willis's white vest from Die Hard, making it orange. I remember just hating Chris Tucker, I remember the film grinding to a halt when he appears. Rewatching it, I realised the film has ground to a halt a lot earlier than that. The film grinds to a halt when they're all trying to get on the ship.
Yeah.
Which is about 50 minutes in.
I mean, let's be honest, the film's never really travelling that fast at any point. I don't know that it has to grind to a halt. I think it just simply slows to a stop. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, that's true. It's,
to be honest, this is like one of the weirdest things about the film. And I couldn't work out whether this was, I'm sure it's not by design, but I do think that the most interesting thing about the film is that it's not a success of dramatic storytelling. It's fair to say that. There are essentially no stakes. I don't care about any of the characters. It seems as though by design, almost, the tone makes it such that I'm not grappling with any of the emotion of the story, of which there is none anyway, really. Having said that, you mentioned the production design already. It is unmistakable. And when you think about the number of tropey and boring sci-fi films that have been made before and since, the reason that the fifth element still comes up time and time again, and it hasn't been forgotten completely by society, is because of the production design. It is unmistakably the fifth element. The film does have sprawl. The world building is effective, and whether you think it's cool or not, I think maybe that's a bit divisive. But I can't think of many films where I'll watch it, and every time I watch it, I'm just confused as to what I'm missing. Because what I'm seeing in front of me visually makes me believe, or gives me pause for thought at least, to think something has to be happening here from a storytelling perspective. But the closer I lean in, the less I see. I mean, I just don't think... I think it's like a complete, huge success on the one hand, and on the other, just a total, vapid failure. And that's why it's so confusing.
Yeah, I think fundamentally the tone of it is so often wrong. It's got all these jarring moments of comedy throughout. It, like, Ian Holm is playing it just about... He's playing it very comedic, but it's Ian Holm, so he gets away with it. But then his second-in-command, Charlie Creed-Miles, he's looking to Ian Holm and he's going, oh, is this the energy? I'm going to do this. And it's like, no, you're not... You can't both do this. And then what you're doing is like you're in Some Mothers Do Have Them. This doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then you've got like the military guys, they come round to see Bruce Willis, and then for
Brian James is the main general, who's also in, I'm just looking at his IMDb now, he's also in Blade Runner and in Striking Distance. He's like, he's in Hot Shots or something, right? Like, he's in a completely different film to everyone else.
Yeah, and then Bruce Willis makes them all hide. Oh, guess who else is actually one of the people who come in? We've talked about her. It's a really famous episode of this podcast where I talk about my memory of watching The Living Daylights.
I don't remember that, sadly.
Oh, it's a classic episode of the podcast. It's where I remember being sexually aroused by the big busty woman from The Living Daylights, and she smothers...
Oh, yeah!
She smothers the Russian guy's head in
it. Is The Living Daylights is a James Bond...
James Bond movie.
That's a James Bond film. That's what you had to say. I didn't know what that was. But no, I remember she's the Russian character. We looked up her character Wikipedia. Is she in the film?
She's one of the three military people who like doorstep Bruce Willis.
Oh, Julie T. Wallace.
Is it? Oh, maybe it's not. Maybe it's completely different.
No, it's her. She's in The Living Daylights. Yeah, she plays Razika Miklos in The Living Daylights, and she plays Major Iceborg in the Fifth Element.
Right, and then so Bruce Willis makes them all hide in his tiny apartment, and like they end up like freezing in his freezer. And it's like, I don't understand. Also, why are you hiding? Because he's asked you to. And then also, why have you frozen to death? But then I think he appears late. The Brian James appears later.
He appears later, yeah. It's total throwaway. Like, it's just like a sketch show at that point, isn't it?
It's very, very strange. Bruce Willis, he's managing to be this, like, this figure of, this constant point of, like, he'll always be Bruce. And he, you know, if the film stayed with him a lot more, it would be fine. But I'm surprised he signed on to it, because it's got the same kind of shit, odd comedic energy as Hudson Hawk, which was a notorious dud for him. I don't think you've ever seen Hudson Hawk. You should watch Hudson Hawk.
I haven't seen it, no.
Richard E. Grant, very funny, very funny.
But maybe he signed on to it because of the success of Leon, which was only 3 years before this, right? So, you know, that was a big success. Everybody liked that. Gary Oldman was in that. Gary Oldman is in this. I don't know. It feels like there are reasons to say yes, aren't there? And actually, the film is at its best when Bruce Willis is in his apartment and in his cab, and when the world is just being explored at the beginning. My favourite scene in the film, and it's my favourite example of the kind of gentle nature of the world building, and the sense of sprawl that you get without really seeing that many different locations and different sets, is when Bruce Willis is sitting at his window and there's a little floating restaurant and he's chatting to the restaurateur and they're obviously friends, or, you know, they know each other. That's such a lovely, lovely moment, because it gives me pause to think about the economics of this scenario. Does this make sense for the restaurant to float around to different windows? Could you ever serve enough people to pay for the fuel? I don't know. But why do they have a relationship? It's never explained. Maybe they just, you know, they chat every day. They're close enough that the restaurateur is willing to make a little bet about the mail to have a free lunch. I don't know. There's a lot about that I really like. And it makes me feel as though I'm being gently dipped into this world. All of those scenes and learning about who Bruce Willis is as a character and seeing him, you know, you've got to say kind of expertly getting across who he is, which, to be fair, is the same Bruce Willis that you've seen in several other films, but getting that across in a very quick time, just one or two scenes near the beginning of the film. That's lovely. You made the point earlier, when the adventure begins, the film loses all of its speed and just becomes mostly boring. But those bits at the beginning have so much promise.
Yeah, what I love about that, the flying noodle stand that comes to his house, what I love about that is just how prescient it is and how Besson has seen how he's foreseen Uber Eats. And I just don't think the film gets that kind of credit, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'm friends with all of my Uber Eats drivers, you know. I've ordered online so many times that I've actually seen the same ones a couple of times, you know. And then we're like a little knowing, hey, it's me again. That's right, you know.
And when you get a certain order, you know, the guy knows what the order is. He hands it over and he goes, oh, trouble in paradise. But then if it's a different order, he kind of goes, oh, trouble in paradise.
Question mark? Yeah. It's basically just a question mark or an exclamation mark, isn't it?
Oh, lucky, you know, gonna be having sex tonight, sir. You know.
Oh, you've bought an extra, there's two McFlurries in here. Someone's looking to pass out and dream of Burger King.
I always liked doing so. Somehow, it feels like going down the hill.
I was going to say, you mentioned Gary Oldman. My tale of the time was Gary Oldman would talk about how working on The Fifth Element meant that he could write and direct and make Nil by Mouth. That's the check that made that film possible. And he said that at the time. So just for that very reason, and also a fantastically fun performance from Oldman. You need more Oldman in this flick. It doesn't matter that film is sort of gibberish. We get Nil by Mouth.
Can I make an observation?
Well, I like to show off about stuff I know.
I mean that's sort of like inherent within, that's imbued within the observation I'm about to make. But listeners may not know, I text you beforehand to say, hey, can we talk about Gary Oldman? Would you mind if I lead that segment? because I've got a structure in mind for it. And you said, oh, daddy, yeah, boy. You know, I was like, oh, great, he's up for it. And so the observation I want to make is that you got in there very early, just quickly there, you got in there with your main fact about Oldman, which Incidentally, I was going to give you time. I knew you would know that. And I was going to give you time to show off in the middle of the structure at the point where it made most sense for you to do that. But instead of trusting me and waiting, you threw it in there before handing the baton because you were worried I was going to read that fact, weren't you? You thought maybe he's going to say the fact. So you said it before I could even start the thing. And now we're all out of whack, aren't we?
We're not out of whack. We're just, this is the middle of a conversation. You said his name, and I thought, oh, I do. I know a thing about Oldman. I knew we were going to get into Oldman. I didn't realise we were going to talk about his directorial work.
Oh, we are. We are. Well, no, we're going to talk about the fact that, like you said, now there's a little bit of information missing from your knowledge there. I don't know if you want, if you're welcome to me to add, I can add something to your fact.
Yes, and please.
Well, here's the thing I would add to your fact. He actually... he didn't want to make the film, really. And there are a lot of interviews with him retrospectively, although he's softened in recent years. There are a lot of interviews with him retrospectively where he talked about how he didn't like the film at all. He agreed to make it with Luc Besson because Besson helped him finance Nil by Mouth. And he agreed to a role in it before he knew what it was or before he'd even read the script. So that's you know, there's sometimes people have questioned... you know, I think his performance is fun, but it is quite divisive. Sometimes people say they don't like it or that they think it's a, you know, I think when they compare it to his performance in Leon, which, you know, they're very different, villains. Yeah, I think some people have suggested that perhaps he wasn't fully in love with the character because that wasn't related to why he took the role. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but that's why it's a testament to what a great actor he is, because he's having the time of his life. He's obviously like, I don't give a shit about this. I'm going to have a Texan accent. I think he has like a Texan accent. I'm going to have this...
very unclear, isn't it?
Very unclear. And he gets what the tone of the movie should be. He gets comedic, but he also gets big and colourful and also quite vicious and scary. Whereas other people... they don't know what movie they're in, and they don't. They can't hold. They can't hold it.
Agree. So listen. Now here's the structure of the Gary Oldman section. Are you ready? What I've done is I've asked our friend Colin if Colin would look at Gary Oldman's timeline and go through and segment chapter Gary Oldman into chapters.
Yeah.
Right. It's something that we try to do sometimes with our actors. I didn't know quite enough about Gary Oldman. To do that, when I was looking through his IMDb, there were a lot of gaps for me. So I thought, let's see what Colin says. And now here's Colin's attempt at it, okay? Obviously, we know that sometimes Colin gets things wrong. And that's why you're here, as you're going to be the check, the measure, okay? So your game, and I know you love this type of game, is to decide whether Colin's right or not, okay? So you just get to go, yeah, or nah, I don't like it, okay?
Okay.
Right, chapter one. Colin calls chapter one... The Angry Young Actor. And this goes from 1979 to 1989. So this is a stage actor who explodes into film, Colin says. Key films in this era, Sid and Nancy, Prick Up Your Ears, and State of Grace, which is just about spilling into the next phase, he says. Here he's earning a reputation for complete physical transformation. People start talking about him as the British De Niro. He's intense, he's unpredictable, and he often plays outsiders. That's the Angry Young Actor.
I would say from this era, the one I know from this is The Firm.
Right.
Where he plays a football hooligan.
Oh, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic film.
Well, he's terrifying.
He's fantastic in it. Chelsea.
He's believably very, very scary.
Yeah. A must see. If you're an Oldman completist, you got to go back and watch The Firm. I tried watching Sid and Nancy and really didn't like it and stopped.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, that was his first film, wasn't it? Looks like it from his IMDb.
He's just, they're horrible. They're horrible characters. And I didn't want to spend any time with them.
Right, okay. So then we move on to chapter two, The Scene-Stealing Villain. This is 1990 to 1997. Now, this is probably, says Colin, the version of Oldman that most people fell in love with. Here's a few key films, and you're going to have seen all of these, I expect. JFK, Bram Stoker's Dracula, True Romance, Leon the Professional, The Fifth Element, Air Force One. Oh, that's a neat run, isn't it? This is peak. Gary Oldman can play absolutely anyone. His performances are huge, theatrical and fearless. He becomes Hollywood's go-to eccentric villain. Do you agree with this? The scene-stealing villain.
Well,
little neat.
It's lacking a little bit of nuance, because whilst Lee Harvey Oswald, you could say he's a villain, he's not really the villain in JFK. He's the patsy.
That's true.
It's more of a character piece, I would say.
Yeah.
In that.
Dracula, definitely a villain, though.
But a romantic one. He yearns. He falls in love.
He yearns.
It's not... Yeah. It's just, you know, it's a completely different sort of villain that he would then play in Leon.
Mm.
So it's interesting. Oh, sorry. Just mid-game. Hello. Hi. Sorry, who's speaking?
Dracula.
Yeah, so what do you want?
Well, you know how we talk about singles night?
Yeah, the last time we went, it was a real disaster, Dracula.
No, yeah, I know, of course. But I see one more happen central Transylvania, and I think maybe me and the Van Helsing, we go together, we meet a sexy, you know... Maybe for me, a sexy vampire. Maybe for you, a sexy human lady. And we could take him back to the castle. We could take him back to the castle and make a sweet, you know what I'm saying, man? I miss you, buddy.
Yes. Yeah, no, I know. I love that about you and the romantic hope you have for singles night. The last time we went, you know, on the speed dating, your body turned into a massive rat. Yeah. And collapsed onto the floor. What did she say? Why did you think that was an appropriate response?
She asked me about my mother, and I kind of freaked out a little, you know.
Is that the trigger for the rat thing?
Well, you know, you human have Freud, Sigmund Freud, yeah. A vampire, we now have Sigmund Freud. We have Sigmund Bloodsucker. he's much the same, and for me, he said that my mother was like a rodent. And so every time somebody in the singles night, when I'm sweaty and scared already, when the singles night, when somebody says about my mother, I turn into a rodent. It's like a, you know, kind of, what they call it, a confirmation bias, you know? But I promise no happen this time. I wear stickers, say don't ask about mother, and, you know, it'd be fine.
Do you want to fall in love, or do you just want to eat some more virgin poontang?
Well, you certainly know how to get me going, Van Helsing. This is why I want to go singles night with you, because you're always talking to me about the virgins, you know. You always like, and hey, I ask you a question, Van Helsing, huh? Do you want to fall in love, or do you simply want to plunge your manhood inside of a virgin?
Well, let's talk about killing. We know it's using the air shaft.
Did they say True Romance in there?
Yeah, True Romance is in there as well.
This isn't villain stuff.
I'm struggling to remember him in True Romance. Is he the villain?
No, he's a character. He's the Drexel. He's a baddie, but it's just like two scenes, best scenes in the movie. He plays Patricia Arquette's pimp. Christian Slater goes to get the money from.
Yes, now I remember. You could get me on that movie, by the way. All I remember about that is Brad Pitt being high on the couch and the Christian, what's his name?
Slater.
No, sorry, the other Christopher
Walken.
Yeah. Thank you. The Christopher Walken scene. I remember that one where he's sitting in the chair, you know. But that's about it. That's all I remember, really.
I'll get you on that, sure. But yeah, these are more kind of scene stealing character pieces,
right?
I would say. I mean, he's the big villain in Leon
and in Air Force One.
That's big blockbuster Hollywood baddie, sure. But that doesn't apply for the rest.
No, fair enough. Okay, next up, the third chapter, The Lost Years. This is 1998 to 2003. Colin says, caveats this by saying, this sounds harsher than it is. He directs Nil by Mouth to enormous acclaim, but as an actor, his career loses some momentum. There are personal struggles, including alcoholism, and the roles become less memorable. He's still excellent, but he's no longer the hottest actor in Hollywood. And I just looking throughout that period, I mean, 1998, he's in Lost in Space, of course, a film we've been promising to do on here for a long time. Fifth Element, that's a few years earlier, that's 1997. And then there's films like The Contender, Nobody's Baby, Hannibal, he's in Interstate 60, Beat the Devil, Medal of Honor, Tiptoes, Sin. I mean, I don't recognize any of these films, do you?
Yeah, some of the earlier ones, but yeah, he's obviously tuning out. And not so fussed anymore.
Bit of a dead era, perhaps. Bit of a pay the bills era.
Yeah, maybe. But I think the nature of the kind of actor he is, he had no right necessarily to bust into Hollywood in the way that he did.
Mm.
And then that's a golden patch. And then if you don't get the right roles that they're not about, you know, then it doesn't happen for you. I think there's a lot of luck involved in an actor's career.
Well, I would say also that He seems to be an actor at the earlier stage where his reputation is built on the notion that he is an eccentric sort of air quotes actor, or all capitalized actor. Do you know what I mean? Like someone who's willing to take risks and be brave and do something strange. I mean, I can think of, you know, a handful of performances that he's given in different films where I feel as though they are close to the line, close to the border between something really cool and interesting to watch and something just really embarrassing to do. Do you know what I mean? And sometimes people's charisma and confidence helps carry something from being a weird, embarrassing thing if most people did it to something that is really cool to watch and just fits perfectly in a film. Thinking of, I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen Leon, but the character that he plays in Leon, I know a lot of people, you know, hold that up as one of the great villains. I remember watching that for the first time and just thinking, like, what the fuck is he doing? This is so strange. It's such a strange accent. It's such a strange performance. I think it's the emotional range of the character and the speed with which he becomes angry from being very quiet is obviously the thing that impressed most people from an acting standpoint. But I think if somebody else did that, somebody with a little bit less charisma and maybe a little bit less British in an American context, I think it's the kind of thing that could very easily be called a terrible performance as opposed to an amazing performance. Do you know what I mean about that?
Yeah, and I like the Drexel performance he does in True Romance is exactly that.
Well, I think that the interesting thing about that is that it makes the next chapter more impressive in some ways. This is chapter 4, The Elder Statesman. This is from 2004.
The Batman Begins years.
Well, I mean, in theory, it's the 2004 to 2012. Colin says this is the reinvention. Key films being Batman Begins, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So instead of flamboyant villains, he starts playing mentors, authority figures, damaged professionals. It's almost the opposite style. The acting becomes quieter and more internal. You compare Zorg, for example, with George Smiley from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It's hard to believe that they are the same actor, which I think is true because one of the things I love about Gary Oldman in the Batman trilogy is how suppressed the character is, how restricted Gary Oldman keeps the performance because, that you know, he is a heroic character and there are moments where you think, another actor might take this slightly higher. Maybe an actor who hasn't already had the highs of playing all of those crazy villains from the past. But he does keep it very small. It is very, he is very internal. And it feels real. It, you know, his Gordon is a grounding character in a very surreal world, I think. And it's, you know, it's one of the most successful things about those films.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, maybe it sounds really obvious to say, like, it's not, it's just the fact that he's older, so that then he can be in these movies. He couldn't be Smiley in The Lost Years.
Sure.
Because he's too young.
Yeah.
So if you wait long enough.
If you're not a leading man, do you think you have to have those fallow years in the middle where you don't get the like the character performances of a young person and then the character performances of a, of an older person? You got to wait in that middle bit.
Yeah, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. That's such an underrated movie. It's such a great performance. It's probably maybe his top in his top three. I'd say top five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely in the top five, isn't it? Top three is a little bit more competitive.
Well, what else? I mean, the thing is, because he's usually not so much in the movie, like Tinker Tailor, he's in it. He's like the main, he's the main guy, and he's in more of the movie.
True.
Feels yeah. like it should get bumped up because of that.
Fair enough.
You get more Oldman for your money.
Yeah, you get more old man. Absolutely. Well, chapter five, this is the final chapter, 2013 to present, The Master Craftsman. By this point, Colin says he has nothing left to prove. Darkest Hour, Mank, Oppenheimer, Slow Horses being thrown in here is, you know, obviously it's not a film, TV. Colin says he's become one of those actors directors cast because they know he'll disappear into a role, whether it's Winston Churchill, Edmund Mankiewicz, or Jackson Lamb.
No, this is Colin clutching at straws. the previous era hasn't ended. This, like, it's just a continuation. Slow Horses doesn't count because it's a TV show, so nonsense.
Sure. I think what the difference here is, like, he won the Oscar for Darkest Hour, didn't he? So I feel like that's what... I'm not disagreeing with you. I think Colin has stretched it. But I think that's why Colin's created a new category, because Darkest Hour was the Oscar winner.
But that's the Scent of a Woman Oscar.
Agree. And I actually don't think it's a very good film.
But... like him popping up in Oppenheimer is effectively him popping up in JFK. If anything, that's him coming full circle. He's not it. He doesn't count him being in Oppenheimer. Truman, I think he plays a very apt black and white. He plays black and white in JFK. Oh, I think I've struck on something there. I've struck on something very interesting. He starts his career in Hollywood playing black and white, trying to kill a president. And then towards the end, oh, black and white and playing a president himself.
There it is. You found it. Well, one final thing I want to ask you about with Oldman, as I like to whenever someone wins an Oscar for acting, is to go back to the year, look at the other people who were nominated, and decide whether the correct person won or not. I personally, I think there's only one other shout in this year. It's not Timothy Chalamet, who was nominated for Call Me By Your Name. I think I would pick Gary Oldman's Darkest Hour over that.
You love that film. Do you not like his performance in that movie?
I do. I don't love the film anymore, I would say. I've rewatched it a few times, and over the last 5 years, I guess, each time I've watched it, I've liked it less and less. I still enjoy it. I still think there's a lot of romance to be found in the film, but its effectiveness has lessened over time. Although I think Timothy Chalamet is very, very, very good in it. But I wouldn't give a whatever 20-year-old Timothy Chalamet an Oscar for that over, you know, a Scent of a Woman style Oscar for Gary Oldman. I'd still, even though I don't like the film Darkest Hour, I'd still give it to Oldman, you know? Another person who was nominated, Denzel Washington in Roman J. Israel-esque. I don't remember that film. I never watched that.
Ooh, yeah, you see, that's...
Is that the one?
It's a really good underrated movie, and it's a really great understated Denzel performance. It's the kind of the antithesis of him in Training Day.
Right. An American legal drama film written and directed by Dan Gilroy.
Yeah, from, I believe that's the Nightcrawler, Gilroy.
Oh, really?
Not, yeah, Tony Gilroy is Michael Clayton, and then you got Dan Gilroy, who's Nightcrawler, and Roman J. Israel. It's a really good movie.
A driven attorney faces several upheavals at his workplace. However, when a cutthroat lawyer recruits him, his willingness to bend the rules is tested.
The thing is, there's not much story to it. It's very understated. It's almost like a character thing. But I don't say that to put people off. It's a good 3.5 starer for me. Okay. That's pretty good. I keep meaning to rewatch it.
Would you give it to him over Oldman's Darkest Hour? Would you give Denzel Washington's Scent of a Woman over Gary Oldman's Scent of a Woman?
Well, yeah, has Denzel even got his Scent of a Woman yet?
I mean, isn't every Denzel film Scent of a Woman? Oh, you mean has he got his Oscar?
Did he get it for Training Day?
Let me check.
Yeah, I feel like he got it for Training Day.
He won Best Actor in 2002. So that was for Training Day. And he won Best Supporting Actor in 1990 for Glory. So he's had his. He's had his.
No, he should have got it for the chops on display for Roman J. Israel, because that would have been him getting it for his acting.
Right. So you think that's like... Did you see Darkest Hour?
No.
Oh. Got it. Okay. Right. Daniel Day-Lewis, Phantom Thread. He's got enough, surely. I know you like Phantom Thread, but, you know. Oh, mother, the toast. Oh, mother, I want milk with the toast, mother. Oh, I've got to make a dress, mother. I've been preparing for 4 years in Italy, you know, and then I'll make a film with my son. Hello, you know. Come on, you don't need another Oscar, mate. You're fantastic. You're fine. He doesn't even want one. He wasn't even there, I assume.
But it's a great performance in a very odd movie.
I never finished the film. I couldn't get through it.
Can I have some Lapsang Soochong tea, mother?
Here's the one I think it should have maybe gone to, is Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out. I think he's great in that film. Really good. And that film, it missed out on Best Film. Did Jordan Peele win? No, he did. Did he? Can't remember. Maybe not.
Is that one of the great Oscar outrages?
I don't think it's a great outrage. It's just like a bit of a shame, isn't it?
I mean, Daniel Kaluuya should definitely have won. When you said who else was up, you sort of hedged it so that there wasn't a clear thing, but yeah, easy. He should easy win for that.
So it won Best Original Screenplay for writer and director Jordan Peele. That's the one it won, but it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor. It didn't win any of them.
What wins Best Director and Best Picture? Because it's all about what stayed in the canon.
Yeah. So.
Yes, Adam. I know. Yes, Adam. Thanks for telling me. I know what the Oscar rules are. I stay up every single Oscars and I watch them with my cousin. And we bet.
So the same movie won for both director and picture. I'll tell you who was nominated as a director. Jordan Peele, obviously, for Get Out. Christopher Nolan was nominated for Dunkirk. Greta Gerwig was nominated for Lady Bird. And Paul Thomas Anderson was nominated.
Scorsese wins, doesn't he?
No, Scorsese doesn't win. Guillermo del Toro was nominated and won for The Shape of Water, which also won the best film.
Shape of Water, yeah. I didn't watch that as a result of it because there was so much Shape of Water chat, and then I watched it 5 years later and really liked
it. It's good, isn't it? Yeah, I did exactly the same thing. I watched it 5 years later as well. The only two films that were nominated for Best Picture that I haven't mentioned are The Post and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
There's some decent qual going around. I guess, Dunkirk should have won Best Picture and Dunkirk should have won Best Director.
I mean, when you compare it to the qual of the following year, the winner was Green Book. Other nominees, Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favourite, Roma, A Star Is Born, Vice.
Ugh, that's, I would say, what a fucking shit year that was.
That's not a particularly strong year. And 2017, just having a quick look at the year before... Now, this one is very strong. Of course, you'll remember that this is the one where La La Land was miscalled for Best Picture. Moonlight was actually won. Arrival also nominated. Hell or High Water was nominated for Best Picture as well, surprisingly. Lion was there. Manchester by the Sea, very strong films. Hidden Figures, Fences, which I didn't love, but I understand people liked it. And Hacksaw Ridge, which I think is a terrible film. But generally, that's pretty high level of quality, I would say.
That's a strong, yeah. So...
Oh, I like this game where we just go through Oscar years and say whether they're strong or not. That's a lot of fun.
It's a riddle. Speak, friend, and enter. What's the Elvish word for friend?
Melon. I've picked one more year, though. At random, I went with 2014 because I like that as a year in my memory. That's like, oh yeah, I was 24 years old and there was a lot going on. I went to the cinema loads that year. Do you remember any films from 2014 that you think might have been nominated for Best Picture? Would you like to try and have a guess?
Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, well, now Wolf of Wall Street, I knew that'd be the only film you remember from 2014. Incredible, incredible lechery. That was there. Martin Scorsese, of course. Other films nominated for Best Picture. Well, the winner, 12 Years a Slave, which is, I've rewatched that now, I would say, three times, maybe. It's a very, very, very good film. That's all I have to say about it. American Hustle, shit film. Captain Phillips, still never seen it.
Oh, I really enjoyed, enjoyed's the wrong word, but it's a very well-made movie and I had a physical reaction at the end of the movie.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, very rare.
Okay.
The end of the film is very powerful.
Well, I've seen so many times that on TikTok the clip of Tom Hanks being rescued and not being able to talk or whatever. Is that the bit you're talking about?
Yes. Oh, great. TikToks ruined the end of the movie.
That's why I've never watched it, because every time I see that scene, I'm like, oh, that looks good. Oh, I guess this is the... Yeah, I won't watch it. Dallas Buyers Club, which was big at the time. I would say somewhat forgotten by culture. Gravity, which didn't win. I thought it did win. But I guess maybe Alfonso Cuarón won for Best Director, and it didn't. And maybe Sandy B. Did Sandy B win? Oh, no. Sandy B didn't win. Cate Blanchett won for Blue Jasmine.
Ugh.
And but Alfonso Cuarón did win for Best Director. What else we got in here? We got Her, Spike Jonze. We've got Nebraska, Philomena. Is the final one on the list. You know, you don't think about Philomena as a Best Picture nominee, do you? But it's very good.
There's quite a few flicks that we've chatted about on the Movies You Forgot podcast. We chatted about Philomena and then we never released it because it was a really boring, quite aggro chat we had face-to-face down in Battle.
Right, yeah. When you do a podcast in Battle, you better be ready to battle. Remember that song? Anyway, that was just a year picked at random. And it hasn't got anything to do with The Fifth Element. But that's also the end of my Gary Oldman list. So...
Well, no, the only reason you read out that list was to say whether you rated what won, and now you've not engaged with that.
Oh, my bad. I just closed it. I forgot all the films on there. What won?
It wasn't 12 Years a Slave, and I think just that by the...
Oh, no, 12 Years a Slave did win. Oh, okay. 12 Years a Slave did
and
win.
And I think by the nature of who you are, you'd say, yeah, fair play. That's the one that should have won.
That's the one that should have won. It's very good.
Yeah, no, it's I couldn't put it back on for a laugh. I need things out of movies.
Yeah.
And I've been through the experience of watching 12 Years a Slave, so I wouldn't pop it on again.
I mean, that's a thing. I guess I understand it because there are films that I wouldn't rewatch, but because the film, there is so much suffering in the film. In fact, you know, the story of the film is obvious that it's about suffering. But there's also so much hope in the film. And there are a lot of moments of love and a lot of examples of characters caring for each other. And there are real moments of gravity in that film. And it's interesting. Because I've had this conversation with my wife several times. There have been several times over the years where I've said to her, we're picking a film, and I've said to her, what about 12 Years a Slave? And she said, I never want to watch that again. And I don't understand it, because For me, that is, what's that Jared Leto film where they take drugs? I forget what it's called.
Requiem for a Dream.
I don't ever want to watch that again because it's disgusting. It's horrible. It makes me feel horrible. I don't like, there's like some body horror elements to it. There, you know, there's the infected scars where they're injecting themselves with these drugs. And it feels as though it is suffering for suffering's sake, right? There's no catharsis at the end of this film. There's nothing there that makes me feel in any way relieved. Whereas I do feel, I know, and this sounds like silly and trite to say about a film that is about slavery, but there is a lot of hope in 12 Years a Slave. It isn't one of those films. It is not suffering for suffering's sake. And I think it is, whilst there is an enormous amount of suffering in the film, it is not, for me as personally as a viewer, it is not a film that is without the elements that make it rewatchable, which I think is greatly to its credit, because it's a film that deserves to be rewatched.
You've nailed it about Requiem for a Dream and how disgusting and filthy that flick is. But like, there's a Paddy Considine directorial debut, Tyrannosaur, which stars Olivia Colman.
Yeah.
You couldn't pay me enough money in the world to rewatch that movie.
Same.
Absolutely.
Agreed. Yeah.
Horrifying.
It's because it's bleak. It is bleak. And while there are obvious, and again, I don't mean I don't want this to sound like I'm underplaying the severity of slavery, there are obvious bleak elements to 12 Years a Slave. 12 Years a Slave is not a bleak film. Tyrannosaur is as bleak as it gets.
Well, I would say most Hollywood movies about slavery, they do have that hope in them. You know, Amistad, Django Unchained.
Django Unchained is fantastic. It's so good. I think that's Quentin Tarantino's best film. I know that's not your opinion, but I think that is his best film. It's definitely his most, for me, like most charismatic, most watchable film.
Yeah, it's just hard for me to say that about a movie when it sort of shits the bed in like with an extra act that it doesn't need. And it,
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, like when something could be perfect. Did you know Will Smith was supposed to be Django?
I did not know that. Is that true?
Yeah.
What was he doing instead?
He was umming and ahhing, and then he this would have been the movie. This is the sliding doors moment of Will Smith's life. If he does Django Unchained, he does not step up on stage and slap Chris Rock in the face.
He doesn't. But also, I'm going to say, Will Smith does not have the range to play Django. He just doesn't. He can't. I don't think he can do it. I don't think he can do it without like bringing his leading man, you know, funny energy. He doesn't work in a. Okay, this is the best. This is the reason why. Remember, in Independence Day, we talked about his relationship, his co-starring alongside your old man. What's your old man called?
Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum, right? Jeff Goldblum is the same as what's your German man called?
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz and Jeff Goldblum, they operate in the same sort of area, okay? They're the same kind of thing. Will Smith and Christoph Waltz do not work together. They don't. One of the things that's so great about Jamie Foxx in Django Unchained is I believe in his transformation. He is like a subdued character near the beginning. He's got a lot of rage, he's got a lot of anger about what's happened to his wife. He's got his mission. But it takes him a while to blossom into the film and to become, you know, Django Unchained more towards the end of the film. I believe in that transformation, and one of the ways that Jamie Foxx does that is by allowing Christoph Waltz to lead the film in the early stages. He's quite subdued in his performance, and I do not believe that Will Smith has that in his locker. I think he wouldn't approach it in the same way.
But yeah, he didn't want to do it, I think, because he thought the language was too fruity, and yeah, he bottled it basically. Imagine that. Imagine bottling it. Imagine having the chance. Imagine he had the chance to John Travolta his career. He was headed for a cul-de-sac. He could have reversed out of it He could have got his Pulp Fiction before he even needed it. He hadn't got to the point where John Travolta's done Look Who's Talking and Look Who's Talking Now.
He wanted to be Tom Cruise, but he's not Tom Cruise.
Well, yeah, I don't know what he wanted to be. Did he ever want to be Tom Cruise?
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy.
Should we do the box office game?
I think we should do the box office game.
What do you think it says about the Fifth Element film podcast episode where we spent maybe half of it talking about Django Unchained?
I think it says that Django Unchained is a really, really good film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, budget brackets estimated, please, for The Fifth Element. Now, what I will tell you is that IMDb actually has the budget listed in French francs, and it's wrong. So I've had to source the correct budget elsewhere. I am informed, though, that Luc Besson himself has referenced this budget in his own book, The Story of the Fifth Element. So we can be relatively confident that this is actually not an estimated budget. This is the budget.
Oh, may we. Formidable.
We may.
It's not going to be in the hundos, is it? It's cost a pretty penny. So off the back of Leon, how much can he convince them to spend on a sci-fi with Bruce Willis?
Well, I guess that's the question, isn't it?
I've never said it before. I'm going to say it now. Mm-hmm. $100 million.
Very close. And you're within the 10%. It was $90 million. At the time, that made it the most expensive European film ever made. Anyway, there we are. One other thing as an aside. $90 million. Obviously, that was a huge amount of money. I mean, it is now, but it was in 1997. It puts the Fifth Element in the same financial league as films like Men in Black, and only a little bit below Titanic's then astonishing budget as well. So a pretty huge gamble for a French-led production. But that's what they say about France. Anyway, opening weekend US and Canada, May 11, 1997. What is this taking? And if they did spend $90 million on it, then how much money do you really need to make it the first weekend?
I mean, they want it to be making, you know, 30 mil. I mean, ideally, they'd want it to make 50, but
ideally, they'd have it make a bill.
They know it's not making that because it's a bit of a punt.
Did you hear that this weekend, just gone, was the biggest box office weekend ever in the history of cinema? Because of Spider-Man and The Odyssey.
Oh, no, I didn't hear that.
It was like something like nearly $500 million just this weekend.
Hey, did you hear that this weekend was the biggest box office return in history?
The Return was released with Ralph Fiennes.
No. It's just I call sex with my wife box office. So, right, and I had the biggest one of those this weekend.
Hey, did you hear that? That this weekend's box office returns were the biggest of all time and the most successful of all time. Did you hear that?
No.
Well, that's what I call sex with your wife, and it was the biggest of all time. So,
no, seriously though, did you hear, Joe? This weekend, box office.
Yeah.
The biggest return on the box office of this weekend.
I didn't hear that.
I know, it's bad.
Right.
I don't even know why. I don't know how that's happened.
I am a golden god! Yeah! Yeah! I am a golden god!
So let's say the Fifth Element made. Is it Jumper Territory? Is it? I don't think it is. I think it's who the Americans are going to be like. Barb, what is this, Barb? What's this? All this orange?
Yeah, yeah.
Alien caboodies.
Is it in French?
Oh, I don't know. Element? A fifth? What's a fifth? I don't even know what a one-fifth is. Never right. mind a fifth.
Yeah, exactly. What are the other four elements? I don't know. Is one of them farts?
Is it $18 million?
Oh, my God, it's $17 million. Very well done. Very impressive. Okay. Wow, you're on for it. You're on for it here. You're on for it here because you were within the 10% first time round.
Well, this is where you usually say, have you read that? Have you read that? Did you read that?
Now, you see, the thing about that is that I don't need to say that anymore because I've said it enough times that now every time you get to a similar situation, it's like a little muscle memory, isn't it? You think it for me. You think my thought for me. And then you actually say your own thought, which was my thought for me. And I don't have to say it. And what I'm going to do now, I'm in the phase where I'm not going to say it. And over time, that muscle memory will ease and new neural pathways will form. And then once that's happened and it's gone past a few times with no mention, I'm going to get you with it again. And it's just going to be as annoying as it was the first time, if not more. Okay, you're on for a full gamut here, to the extent where I'm starting to think you may have read that somewhere. Gross worldwide. What do you think? Is it a grower or a shower?
I don't think this is a grower. It's an oddity.
Well, now let me suggest something to you. Could this was French. There were reasons to be concerned about it as an American viewing public. Maybe it's a grower. We've also experienced this with European films before, haven't we? Where actually the 10x rule doesn't necessarily apply because the 10x rule works better when it's an American movie, and the US-Canada opening weekend might not be a reflection of the global box office receipts for a big European film. Just bear that in mind, okay?
Yeah, but that's just the big most amount of money it's going to make is in America.
Right.
So if it will do well in Europe because Bruce is going to travel the world, but it's like how well it goes down. I need to get the meat of my money is like how much money does it make in America? Then you're adding on another whatever 70, 80 mil on top of that.
Right. Yeah.
So does it have legs in America? I fucking doubt it. Maybe it makes its money back.
Does it have legs in America?
I just remember this being something of a little bit of a disappointment slash, like, everyone thinking, what is this movie? He does get to make Valerian years later. So it kind of lost money. So does it make... I'd say nice even number again. Even number, $200 million.
Well, pretty close. Not close enough, unfortunately. Because overall, the film grossed $264 million.
Oh, okay.
Dollars,
bit more.
Which is quite a lot, isn't it? Quite a lot. What did you say? You said that you thought the film would have made most of its money in America.
Did it make most of its money abroad?
It made $64 million in America and Canada, and it made $200 million internationally.
Wow. The flip.
It's the other way. Because I guess there are many more people outside of America than there are in America, you know? But most of the time you might think, well, I don't know, you want like English-speaking people only for a film like this. But there are... How many people are there in... There are more people in Europe, aren't there, than there are in America? And... I reckon this movie would have done well in somewhere like places like Brazil. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I don't know. It's just a feeling I've got. It's just a sort of vibe I'm picking up from the film. I watched the film and I think this is kind of like a Brazilian movie, you know?
Yeah.
I've decided.
Yeah. I think it's the kissing of a passed out woman that gave you that feeling. That's very Brazilian.
Yeah.
Don't want to get angry emails from... I'd take any emails, to be honest, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you get that many emails, do you? Just one or two?
I mean, you say me, it's the podcast.
Have you ever thought that because I repeatedly tell people that I don't read the emails, that maybe that's why we don't get that many?
Not even thought. I know that for a fact.
Oh. You know it without thinking it?
But yeah, no, I've thought that for ages.
Oh, right. Well, it's less fun for me when you react in that way.
Who the fuck am I? I'm nobody.
That's not true.
No.
Or somebody.
No, I'm not. It's fine. But, you know, it's more of an admin annoyance, you know.
Right. Yeah. I don't like it when you do this thing. It's very rare that you do this, but because generally it catches me out whenever you do it. I come in really hard at you because you always respond hard. And then very occasionally you just go, yeah, I'm nobody. And then I go, hang on. Wait, that's not fair.
It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo. The ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end. Because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened?
Victory! We have victory!
But in the end, it's only a passing thing. This shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. And when the sun shines, it'll shine out the clearer. Those were the stories that stayed with you. That meant something. Even if you were too small to understand why. But I think, Mr. Frodo, I do understand. I know now. Folk in those stories had lots of chances of turning back, only they didn't. They kept going. Because they were holding on to something.
What are we holding on to, Sam?
That there's some good in this world, Mr. Farrell. And it's worth fighting for.
Joe, should we do the bit in the show where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot with a view to catching out the other one on a movie they forgot?
Yes, please. It's my go, I think, because you got me on The Fifth Element.
You kindly let me get you on a movie that you knew I'd seen.
Which, by the way, I'm kind of pissed off about having watched the film, because you had already watched the film. You'd made that choice just of your own accord, mistake as it was, and then knowing it was a mistake, you asked me to watch it, which we've never done that before, have we? Because generally, when we suggest a film, we both have to do the time. Whereas in this instance, it was like you'd already done the time. You knew exactly how that time was spent. And you still made me watch it.
Did you not enjoy rewatching it?
No.
Was it a slog?
It's boring. Yeah, it's a slog. It's boring. It's boring. I don't care about it. I don't care about any of the characters. There's nothing to be interested in.
Yeah.
It's boring.
Yeah, it is.
It's like watching art made by a robot, you know? I don't fucking care.
I usually hate when you call a movie boring because I think, well, that's a taste thing. But yeah, it's right. Boring. This movie is really boring.
We both have the same taste. Great. Right, it's my turn to get you. And amazingly, the first film on my list is a film that you've already mentioned on the podcast. Now, I think this is not going to be a plum. I know that. You already referred to it today as your era of Tarantino. But we've talked about Jackie Brown a number of times. I've seen it the once, 20 years ago. I don't remember anything about it. So it's definitely a plum forgot you forgot for me. And I feel like it is one of, apart from The Hateful Eight or whatever, it's like the least talked about of Tarantino's movies. So even if you personally haven't forgotten it, I think it is a forgot you forgot in the culture. So I'd like to put that forwards.
Oh, that's annoying because we've been talking about Tarantino and Django Unchained for about 50 minutes on a completely different related podcast.
exactly the kind of thing we'd do. Maybe next week we'll talk about Luc Besson. I mean, we won't, but you know, we might.
No, that would be really, really a real waste of our Tarantino card.
Sure. By the way, I can't believe we didn't do Leon, because obviously the one to do is Leon. We're never doing Luc Besson again now, I know, about everything. So it's a shame.
Yeah, but you know? Can't really talk about Leon, because it's kind of a bit pervy and gross.
Because it's pedo-y in and of itself.
Yeah.
You're right, I forgot about that.
It's in the text.
Yeah.
I used to have Jackie Brown. I used to have a Jackie Brown t-shirt.
Really?
Yeah. It had a film... A film still. It was like the poster across, like the. I'm doing this, like
you're sort of bannering across your chest.
Bannering, yeah. And it's also for a long time. It was the Tarantino movie. I'd say, oh yeah, that's my favorite Tarantino. You know,
because it makes you sound cool.
You want to catch people out, not for a long time, just for a little bit.
No, sure.
Just for a little bit of time. But
sounds like you're conceding.
Yeah, haven't thought about it. I haven't watched it in ages.
Mm-hmm.
And I want us to do. I feel like, you know, after your World Cup break, we're moving into a new era of the podcast where we are going to span our
wings. We're on it together.
Well, we're just going to start talking about movies we actually want to talk about.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's good.
And rewatch.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think Jackie Brown is a movie that people have forgot. They forgot. It's not chatted about enough. And I'd love a reason to rewatch it. So
great. Let's do it.
It's long. It's long, man. It's a long movie.
Yeah.
Oh, also, it's got Chris Tucker in. It's got.
Has it?
It matches.
It's got the Tuckster.
Chris Tucker is so good in Jackie Brown.
Right. I mean, I don't remember anything about it apart from the one thing I remember is her walking into an underground parking lot.
Across 110th Street.
Ah, is that song in it? I love that song.
Yeah. Across 110th Street. But yeah, a lot of parking lots in this flick. I've said Sliding Doors in this podcast. Sliding Doors for Big Willy was Django Unchained. Sliding Doors for Quentin Tarantino was the response to Jackie Brown. If the critics had hoovered that up and it had made boffo box office,
he would have continued to make films you liked forever.
Oh, not just that. Society, culture and society that we know would be completely different.
Quentin Tarantino would have solved society.
Well, I'm not saying it could have been worse. It could be worse. I'm just,
would
I
there
don't
have
know.
Been any Me Too?
Just saying it would be different. Fuck's sake, why do you have to bring everything down to Me Too? No, like, you know, he would not have made the Kill Bills.
Just because sometimes I think there's like the time before Me Too and the time after, much like the time before 9/11 and after. Now, let me ask you a question. Was Jackie Brown made before or after 9/11?
Before. That means it was also before Me Too as well.
Interesting. I'm just lodging that. So for when I watch the film, I know I'm watching a film that was made before 9/11 and long in advance of Me Too. Now, of course, it's a Quentin Tarantino film, so I won't be worried about that second part of it. But the first part, it's good for me to know. Locking it in now, this film was made before Western culture changed forever with 9/11.
Yeah. And you'll be able to go, this movie's so the 90s. Nothing tells me this movie's more the 90s than this, this, and this.